content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading from the July 3rd, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the, it's like the parade balloon of the Trump baby. I think somebody floated that at some point. It's up in the air. On the ground, John Bolton has got a bow and arrow, and he's shooting arrows at the float, and he's popped it. There's air coming out. And on the other side, Bill Barr, he's got a roll of blue tape, and he's patching up holes in the balloon to keep it from deflating. And the title is Deflated, A Failed Rally, the Pandemic, and Disastrous Polls Leave Trump's Campaign Reeling. And I'm sure our first main story is exactly that. We'll start right there, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's deflating campaign launch, what happened? President Trump's reelection campaign was left reeling this week after a Tulsa rally conceived as a triumphant return to the public stage for the beleaguered president fizzled out amid low turnout. The 19,000-seat Bank of Oklahoma Center was only a third full for the Saturday event, leaving a glaring sea of empty blue seats. Trump had promised a crowd like nobody's seen before in the campaign, boasting of over a million ticket requests, set up an outdoor stage where Trump was slated to address an overflow crowd that never materialized. The TikTok users claimed credit for boosting expectations, with a campaign rallying teens and others to sign up for tickets they had no intention of using. But the impact of the stunt was dismissed by Trump campaign officials, who said attendance was dimmed by fears of the virus drummed up by the fake news media, and claimed groundlessly that demonstrators had blocked access to the arena. Radical protesters, coupled with a relentless onslaught from the media, attempted to frighten off the president's supporters, said communications director Tim Murtaugh. Trump was rambling and combative in his 103-minute speech. He spoke dismissively of the coronavirus, calling it the Chinese virus and Kung Flu, said he'd told officials to slow the testing down because it made the U.S. look bad, and cracked that a 10-year-old with sniffles would be counted as a positive case. He called Black Lives Matter protesters thugs and cast Joe Biden as a tool of a left-wing mob that wants to demolish our heritage. It was a theme Trump returned to days later when he gave a more energetic speech to 3,000 student supporters in a jammed Phoenix megachurch. If you give power to people who demolish monuments and attack churches, set fire to buildings, then nothing is sacred and nothing is safe, he said. Several national polls showed Biden opening up a double-digit lead on Trump, with a New York Times Siena College poll showing the Democrat ahead 50-36%. A Marquette University poll had Biden opening an 8-point lead in swing state Wisconsin, and other state polls showed him with narrower leads in Arizona, Florida, and Pennsylvania. What the editorial said: Trump faced a moment of truth in Tulsa, said the Washington Post. Kicking off his reelection campaign, he could double down on the politics of division or try to broaden his appeal with modest efforts at conciliation and healing. Trump chose the low road, offering defenses of Confederate statues and an imaginary scenario in which a very tough hombre breaks into a woman's home. The ugly, mean-spirited display makes more evident than ever the urgency of evicting him from the White House. Trump is damaged but not beaten, said the Washington Times. From the start of his presidency, he's faced a relentless stream of political missiles that aim to convince Americans that their patriotism is false pride. He's been besieged by Russiagate, impeachment, the pandemic, and now social media giants mounting sleazy attempts to censor his online posts. He and his supporters know the United States remains a beacon for those fleeing racism and other sicknesses of the soul. What the columnist said. Tulsa revealed an Emperor Orangius with no clothes, said Tim Miller in TheBulwark.com. His claim to be an economic genius has been punctured by 13% unemployment. He doesn't know how to manage a pandemic or unite a fragmented country or offer a vision for a second term. So he didn't go to Tulsa to address any of this. He just wanted an adoring throng. And he didn't even get that. Trump has only one re-election theme, fear, said Walter Shapiro in NewRepublic.com. Beyond the empty seats, the rally's lasting image was the sheer ugliness of Trump's fear-mongering. In his warnings of a full-scale assault on American life under President Biden, he essentially suggested that Democrats want to put religious believers in concentration camps. Prepare for a re-election campaign scripted by Roy Kahn from on high. Trump may be headed for a landslide defeat in November, said Josh Krashauer in NationalJournal.com. Tulsa offered a foreboding sign. His once rock-solid base is softening. His dismal polling shows slippage even among evangelical and rural voters, and facing the triple threat of a pandemic, a tanking economy, and racial divisions, even some of the president's supporters are questioning whether he's up for the job. To win, Trump needs a miraculous turnaround. It's too soon to count Trump out, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. At this time in 2016, headlines and polls also prophesied his doom. Still, images of empty seats and Trump strolling off Marine One disheveled and doleful at the night's end will linger. They may create a dynamic that Trump, the consummate marketer, understands as well as anyone. Once you look like a loser, there's a danger voters will treat you like one. The controversy of the week, related to the same main story. Bolton, will his revelations damage Trump? Now he tells us, says Benjamin Witz and Quinta Jurek in TheAtlantic.com. In defiance of the Trump administration's efforts to squelch the book, John Bolton has finally published The Room Where It Happened, a withering memoir of the mustachioed former National Security Advisor's 18-month stint in Donald Trump's White House. It's chock full of revelations the public should have gotten months ago during Trump's impeachment trial. Bolton does confirm that, yes, Trump personally told him he was withholding military aid from Ukraine to extort its president into announcing a sham investigation of Democratic rival Joe Biden. But it's the other details about Trump's erratic behavior and amoral character that are so damning, said Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post. Bolton says Trump reads virtually nothing and is so ignorant that he thought Finland belonged to Russia. He has a penchant for giving personal favors to dictators he liked, including Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and North Korea's murderous Kim Jong-un. Trump pleaded with China's Xi Jinping to help make sure I win by buying soybeans and wheat from American farmers, and told Xi his detention of a million Uyghurs in concentration camps was exactly the right thing to do. Every decision Trump made, Bolton says, was driven by re-election calculations. There's nothing new here, said Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. Yes, Bolton quite plausibly depicts a president with a gargantuan cynicism about the game of politics. But guess what? That justified cynicism is shared by the voters who elected him in 2016. Will they really be horrified to learn that behind the scenes, Trump is just as combative, transactional, and freewheeling as he is in public? As for the supposedly damning revelation that Trump has at times conducted foreign policy with an eye on the next election, said David Keene in the Washington Times, that puts him in the ignominious company of Teddy Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and virtually every president. It's a difference of degree, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. Other presidents may have sometimes let re-election calculations influence their decisions or exploited the power of their office for political reasons. But what Bolton describes is a president who openly and defiantly sees his office as an instrument to advance his own personal and political interest over those of the nation. The spineless Senate Republicans who acquitted Trump in the impeachment trial knew full well that's how he operates, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. But Bolton's book lets us marvel afresh at the gobsmacking amorality of those who have made his nightmare presidency possible. Let's save some infamy for Bolton himself, who kept silent about what he knew until he could make a buck on it. If Trump succeeds in his vow to prosecute and jail Bolton for supposedly revealing classified information, no one will weep. That's unfair, said Thomas Wright in the Atlantic.com. Bolton was willing to testify in the impeachment trial if Republican senators had supported the subpoena, and they wouldn't have voted to remove Trump anyway. Bolton deserves credit for spilling the beans before the election when it can still make a difference. Trump's niece Mary is about to publish a tell-all memoir of damaging family secrets that is reportedly a dagger, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. As Trump's fortunes fade, former aides such as H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson may try to get on the right side of history by telling some secrets of their own. A tipping point for Trump may fast be arriving. And the Good Week, Bad Week segment. Let's see what we've got. It was a good week for fans after Major League Baseball and players finally reached an agreement to start a truncated 60-game season on July 23rd, followed by playoffs and a World Series. No fans will be in the stands, at least initially. It was a good week for carrying on with news that the annual Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Competition will be held without fans on July 4th in New York's Coney Island. Joey Chestnut, the 12-time champion, hopes to break his own record of 74 hot dogs in 10 minutes. If I'm feeling it, said Chestnut, 77 is doable. And it was a good week for bad boys. After new research found that women are less attracted to men who pose with their cat in dating profiles. Men with cats were judged by many women to be more agreeable and open, but less masculine, more neurotic, and less dateable. But it was a bad week for Britain's Prince Charles, who has not yet regained his sense of taste or smell after contracting COVID-19 in mid-March. Charles nonetheless feels he got away with it quite lightly for a man of 71. It was a bad week for Dubliners, with reports that a pandemic-related cutback of pest control efforts has caused a plague of rats in the Irish capital. Some of the rats are so big, said former mayor Criona de Dale, that you would only be short of putting a saddle on them. And finally, it was a bad week for the Segway personal transporter, which will cease production on July 15th. Hailed at its launch 20 years ago as a device so revolutionary that cities will be designed around it, the gyroscopically stabilized device will be mainly remembered as Kevin James' preferred conveyance in Paul Blart, Mall Cop, and Mall Cop 2. Thank you. Our briefing page article is titled Election Day Nightmares. If the presidential election is close, chaos is likely to result. There might not even be a declared winner. What could go wrong? The coronavirus pandemic could wreak havoc at the polls, especially if November finds us in the midst of a second wave, as many infectious disease experts predict. The potential for disaster was made evident in recent primaries. Shortages of workers caused by fear of the coronavirus led to shuttered and understaffed polling places, creating log jams that left voters waiting for hours in long lines to cast a ballot. That happened in Maryland, Georgia, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere, and problems are expected to be far worse in November, when voter turnout will be considerably higher. We're just going to have a catastrophe, said Michael McDonald, a political science professor at the University of Florida who studies elections. What about mail-in ballots? They should help ease the crush at polling places, but counting them will create new problems. It takes a long time to tally them under the best of circumstances, and many municipalities may not be prepared to deal with an unprecedented avalanche of mailed-in ballots. Again, the primaries have offered a preview. In Idaho, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, mail-in ballots were still being counted more than a week after the election date. Imagine a scenario where the outcome of the presidential election is hanging on results in Michigan and Pennsylvania, and for days after November 3rd, mail-in ballots in those states are still being tallied, verified, and challenged. It would create major confusion and chaos, and there's wide concern that President Trump would fan the flames. What might Trump do? It's highly likely that if Trump faced a potential loss, he'd claim the vote was illegitimate. He has a long history of alleging voter fraud and election theft without evidence, groundlessly claiming, for example, that he'd have won the popular vote in 2016 if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. He's been laying the groundwork for contesting November's results by continually claiming, again, without evidence, that mail-in voting enables massive fraud and will lead to, as he put it in a recent tweet, the greatest rigged election in history. Imagine a scenario in which Michigan is the pivotal state in the Electoral College, and Trump is leading the vote there after the polls close, but over a fraught, frenzied week of counting, mail-in ballots from heavily Democratic Detroit give the race to Biden. Trump could basically claim fraud, and we don't really have mechanisms to deal with that, said Stephen Levitsky, a political science professor at Harvard and co-author of How Democracies Die. Then there's an even more unsettling possibility, that no winner is named at all. How could that happen? The Constitution left some ambiguities and holes in the mechanics of the Electoral College. Lawrence Douglas, a law professor at Amherst College, explains how this could lead to an electoral nightmare in a new book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Let's say the election comes down to a single state that's barely won by Biden, but whose state legislature is controlled by Republicans. Michigan could be such a state. The legislature could back Trump's claim that he was denied victory by fraud and move to give him the state's electoral votes. Under another scenario, the legislature and the state's Democratic governor could send competing electoral certificates to Congress, which tallies the final Electoral College vote. It would then be up to Congress to decide which certificate is valid, and if the House is controlled by one party and the Senate controlled by the other disagree, there is basically no way to resolve the dispute, Douglas said. There's a Chernobyl-like defect built into our system of presidential elections that really could lead to a meltdown. Regardless of the circumstances, if Trump loses a close election, it is quite possible he will insist he's the legitimate president and refuse to leave the White House. What happens then? Few expect he would succeed. At noon on January 20, 2021, the Secret Service and military are constitutionally mandated to shift their allegiance to the declared winner, assuming there is one. To hold on to power would require the president to get multiple people to fairly blatantly disregard their oath to uphold the Constitution, said Georgetown Law Professor David Super. But militia uprisings and other civil violence aren't hard to envision. More important is the critical damage to the republic that could be inflicted by a president who broke with more than two centuries of tradition by refusing to accept his loss as valid. Implicit in a democracy is the idea that voters accept the results as legitimate, said Richard Hasson, a law professor at the University of California, Irvine, who's written a book on the 2020 race called Election Meltdown. If you don't have that, then you don't have a democracy. Turn to a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. Statue attacks have gone too far. Conservatives saw all this coming, said Noah Rothman. As we predicted, woke progressives are now coming for the founding fathers. Rage over racial discrimination has evolved into an all-out attack on monuments to any historical figure associated with slavery. In Portland, Oregon, protesters defaced and tore down statues of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. Our first president, they said, was a genocidal colonist. Another statue of Washington was vandalized in Illinois, and New York City is removing a statue of Jefferson from City Hall. Christopher Columbus statues in several cities are also facing removal, and protesters in San Francisco toppled the statue of Ulysses S. Grant, the general who defeated the Confederacy. Yes, we are now having an overdue reckoning with Confederate flags and statues, but the frenzied efforts to erase all historical figures with problematic legacies lack any limiting principle. Jefferson, for example, was the author of one of the most expansive definitions of what constitutes human liberty in history, and gave us all men are created equal. It's self-indulgent extremism to judge our forebears by the standards that prevail today. In tearing down statues of Washington and Jefferson, we are erecting monuments to ourselves. Hijacking the Voice of America. The Voice of America may be turning into the Trump News Network, said the Boston Globe. After a two-year battle, the Trump administration has succeeded in installing right-wing ideologue Michael Pack, an ally of White House nationalist, of white nationalist Steve Bannon, as head of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which controls the Voice of America, Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, and other parts of a global news service that reaches 280 million people in 60 countries. In giving citizens of other countries news from America's point of view, these outlets have always operated free of government interference, but that is now likely to change. Trump was infuriated by the Voice of America's coverage of the coronavirus outbreak, saying it failed to blame China. PAC immediately began a purge, and officials of the news operations are already being replaced by Bannon allies and ideological extremists. An exultant Bannon proclaimed, "Now patriots can begin the process of cleaning up the mess. Congress needs to conduct an inquiry to see whether the $637 million in taxpayer funds the VOA has requested will pay for something they can be proud of, or whether it will serve as a propaganda outlet for one man, Donald Trump." This is from the United Kingdom. A fumbling Boris sinks in the polls. Has Boris Johnson lost his mojo? The British Prime Minister has recovered from his recent bout with COVID-19, which landed him in intensive care for 3 nights in April. But since his discharge from the hospital, he has not been the same man. A chunky 242 pounds when he got sick, the 56-year-old conservative is convinced that obesity played a role in his illness, and he is now obsessed with slimming down. Johnson runs, plays tennis, and reportedly harangues his colleagues about their weight. Still, the former journalist seems slower and less energetic, his famed wit dulled. In the new leader of the opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, he faces an ingenious human rights lawyer who bests him at question time in the House of Commons every week. When Johnson announced he was taking direct control of the coronavirus response, after nearly 43,000 COVID-19 deaths, the highest toll in Europe, Starmer asked gently, "Who has been in direct control up to now?" Johnson simply gaped. Nor can the Prime Minister rebut inquiries about why his government has failed so spectacularly on its promises, such as rolling out a coronavirus track and trace program. The wordsmith has become wordless. "Everything seems to be going wrong for Johnson," said Luigi Ippolito. His approval rating has crashed to around 40%. And last week, he literally crashed. A security vehicle rear-ended and dented his Jaguar outside Parliament. The accident came just a day after Johnson was forced to make a humbling U-turn and agree to keep funding meals for poor school children through the summer after Manchester United soccer star Marcus Rashford, who experienced food poverty as a youngster, publicly pleaded with the government not to abandon hungry kids. "Perhaps our prime minister is distracted by his incredibly cliched midlife crisis," said Marina Hyde in The Guardian. Johnson recently left his second wife for someone very much younger, 32-year-old PR guru Carrie Symons, and has become obsessed with ludicrously showy high-performance vehicles. He's got himself a dirt bike to tear around his official country residence, and has pulled a Led Zeppelin and demanded that the prime ministerial plane be given a splashy $1.25 million paint job. And Johnson has also requested that money intended for overseas aid instead be spent on two new yachts to replace the Royal Yacht Britannia. "Still, this past week has been encouraging," said Alistair Heath in the Daily Telegraph. "To the great relief of its base, the Conservative government is getting its act together. Johnson has announced a crackdown on vandals who deface statues, such as the Black Lives Matter protesters who graffitied a statue of Winston Churchill in London's Parliament Square, and a new cross-governmental commission to tackle entrenched inequalities, racism, and poverty. He needs to be just as robust on reopening lockdown Britain, jettisoning the 6-foot social distancing rule so that pubs and schools can operate at capacity. He must display leadership, passion, and optimism. In short, be the optimistic can-do Boris we elected 6 months ago." And we'll go ahead and turn right over to the last word, our in-depth article title this week, "The Risks We Are Willing to Run." With coronavirus a continuing threat, we need to make rational and emotional calculations about what's safe, said ER Dr. Amita Studier in Slate.com. How we do that tells us about our limits and our values. As states continue to open up, but COVID shows no signs of magically disappearing, many of us are asking ourselves, what is the safe and responsible thing for me to do? Even if my state says it's legal for me and 100 of my closest friends to cavort around a swimming pool in close quarters, swilling margaritas, should I? How much do I owe it to my fellow humans to stay at home? And how much can I allow myself to taste just a little bit of freedom? I'm an emergency physician, and I have been mulling this over in my head for weeks. I fielded a few questions from friends that start with, am I a bad person if... This seems to be the crux of the problem. Just because something is allowed does not mean it is safe or necessary. Each state seems to be approaching this with varying degrees of scientific insight and common sense, which certainly adds to the confusion. But more broadly, there are simply many things that I have chosen not to do for safety reasons, even though they are not against the law. For instance, I don't own a gun. I wouldn't hurdle at highway speeds in the back of a pickup truck, even if I lived in South Dakota, where such an activity would be legal. I would never skydive. So, should I just ignore the fact that restrictions are easing and stay home? Well, I haven't. Yes, we would all be safer at home if you had the ability to ride out the pandemic however long it took by staying home, growing and cooking your own food, ordering nothing off the internet, and avoiding contact with anyone except those who had chosen to isolate themselves with you. You could be 100% guaranteed not to be infected with coronavirus. You would also be guaranteed not to die in a car accident, an occurrence whose lifetime risk is 1 in 100 for people who live in this country. And yet, most of us drive every day. Responsible people take risks all the time in the course of normal life. And as responsible people, out of regard for ourselves and others, we take steps to mitigate those risks. We drive but wear seatbelts. We bike to work but wear helmets. We drink alcohol but don't get behind the wheel of a car right afterward. We have swimming pools in our yards but have fences around them. So can we return to some semblance of normal, but do it without endangering ourselves or others? For every activity I think about going back to, I consider the opportunity costs. For example, just as Virginia began to ease restrictions, a local sports club reopened its outdoor tennis courts. I called a friend and we played tennis for an hour. We were well over 6 feet apart, and although we obviously had indirect contact through the balls, we were careful not to touch our faces, and we watched our hands afterward. It felt safe and also exhilarating. Did I absolutely need to play tennis? Of course not. Was it terribly risky? Probably not. Did it make me happy? Undoubtedly, it did. And we are all in need of a little happiness right now. The value of life is not just in the simple act of living it, but in how you do so. I know that people want to be safe and healthy, but that they also want art and laughter and music and bourbon to create them and to consume them. Not everyone can do those things in lockdown, but if you can, how do you decide? There are three things that enter my calculus for what I should and shouldn't do right now. The first, am I putting anyone else at risk? For me, anyone else includes all my patients, so I feel acutely responsible for making sure I am safe. For many people, anyone else will be family members or close associates who are elderly or have other risk factors for getting very sick from COVID. I consider the downstream effects of increasing my risk on those whose well-being I am responsible for. Without this, being youngish, 42, and with no chronic illness, I might be tempted to be more cavalier. The risk to other people is perhaps the most complicated to determine. When I think about visiting my parents who are in their 70s, I worry about infecting them, and of course it would be safest to stay away. But I also worry about them feeling isolated and the fact they miss their grandchildren. So one weekend, just as Virginia began to lift restrictions and I had not worked a shift in the ER for 5 days, I drove my family up to see them, and we sat in their living room with masks and on their back porch without them. If case numbers climb where I work, I probably will feel less safe visiting them and will stay away. But if this drags on for 10 years without a vaccine, I imagine I will then feel differently. They and I will weigh the risk of them getting COVID and dying against the sorrow of missing their grandchildren growing up. And perhaps we will all decide the risk is worth it. Because I consider myself a possible risk to others because of my job, I might not invite friends over for dinner inside my house right now, but I might consider grilling in the backyard with people I trust to wear masks in public, wash their hands, and realize that the coronavirus really is a threat. This is a time to reflect upon the company we keep. If we gave freely of ourselves in the pre-COVID era, perhaps it is time to consider just how important any given person is in our lives. Some people we were friendly with before just might not make the cut. There is legitimate value right now in keeping one social circle a little bit smaller. A second consideration is the risk of activity I want to partake in against the importance to me. And although some of the things I would like to do could be categorized as frivolous, I intend to do them anyway. Friends have asked me, are pedicures safe? Perhaps they are, and so may be spa visits and haircuts. Weeks after two Missouri hairstylists exposed more than 100 customers to COVID because they worked while sick, no customer has yet tested positive at the time of writing. If this remains true, it suggests that close quarters with masks, which the two stylists were both wearing, might be okay. While none of these activities are essential, they are things many of us are longing to do. And what we have learned is that there are real ways to make them safer. Physical distancing, masks, and good working conditions for employees. If you don't long to do something, then maybe holding off on doing it for now is the best option. For example, there is no dearth of movies on Netflix I haven't seen. So going to see a new release in the theater holds no fascination for me. But if everyone is 6 feet apart at the movies and wearing masks, armchair movie critics might choose to make this their first pandemic outing. Similarly, if I couldn't drive to see close family, I might consider getting on a plane, but would wear a mask and bleach wipe my surroundings. Each of us will decide with a certain degree of arbitrariness what we consider safe and important. But I wouldn't go to a crowded bar or a pool party where no one is wearing a mask, no matter how much I wanted to. That would clearly just not be safe right now. It's not just the frivolous that concerns me. As the days with COVID march on, some of the things we have been avoiding will become necessary. Adults will need to go back to work, and we'll need to send our children to school and daycare. How will we learn how and teach our children how to be safe in those settings? The CDC has published mitigating strategies for schools and businesses, and we will want to know that our employers and school districts are taking them seriously. While there is data that suggests children aren't a huge source of transmission, we really won't know how safe school is until we have tried it. I intend to send my children back as soon as schools are open, but I imagine there will be some parents who won't want to. Until that long-awaited back-to-school day arrives, I'll try to ingrain COVID safety in my kids. They now always wash their hands for 20 seconds and leave their shoes by the door, and they are learning to be comfortable in masks. And for us adults, the skills we acquire and our occasional forays into the world will serve us well when work in an office is a regular occurrence again. Not touching our faces and sanitizing obsessively will have to become a second nature. We've already contended with decisions about something that is morally necessary, protesting. People have done integrated strategies to mitigate their risk of COVID even as they march and kneel in the streets. My last consideration as I weigh how I will go back to normal life is not about my risk of getting COVID. It's about the risk I pose to the broader world. Carbon emissions across the world are down 17%. Skies are clearer. Previously obscured mountains are visible. Snow leopards are being spotted where they have never been seen before. The pandemic has given us a glimpse of a dire future, but also one of a better earth that may actually be attainable. Now that we know we can go a few months without doing certain things, why not go without them forever? So I will also ask myself, Will this activity allow me to tread lightly upon the earth? And if it doesn't, do I really need to do it? That's one thing I've taken away from this time apart. You might have had your own realization of what you'd like to pay more attention to in your life. Once I decide to do something, I set myself assiduously to the task of making it as safe as possible. As evidence accumulates in favor of masks, there really is no excuse for not wearing them. Using hand sanitizer before and after activity seems prudent. Keeping a 6-foot distance from others when possible should be easy. An event with 10 people is safer than one with 20. Having your best friend over for cocktails in the backyard is probably fine. Having the guy you just met on Tinder over to snuggle on the couch probably isn't. We might ask what businesses are doing to keep us and their employees safe and choose the ones that are following the rules. Our local gelato place recently reopened. They sanitized my credit card before handing it back to me, and both employees in the store washed their hands after serving us. I can't wait to go back. It will be a little while before we know exactly how dangerous certain things are, so it makes sense to start with baby steps, and for those baby steps to be the things we really care about. Things that don't make us feel like we are teetering on the COVID precipice. As we navigate how to live with COVID in our lives, we will misstep in either direction as we walk the fine line between safety and freedom. I felt a little frisson of anxiety as I bit into the manchego a friend served me on the porch. Was it okay to do that? I still don't really know, and that uncertainty is something we will have to learn to live with. There's a lot of shaming on the internet of people who want to go out and do things, and this makes us question our desire to do so. Yes, we all want to survive this pandemic, but we also need to learn to live with COVID around us and take steps to protect ourselves and our communities. Ultimately, most of the risk we will all take won't be about pedicures or haircuts or eating at a steakhouse. They will be about seeing the people we love, being with the people who sustain us, interacting in a way that makes us feel human. While love can be expressed in an email, on a computer screen, in a phone call, those digital forms of communication are no substitute for sharing the same physical space with another person, even if the words are the same. And wanting that closeness does not make you a bad person. Just wear a mask when you do it. This article originally appeared in Slate.com. Read a couple of the short pieces on the health and science page this week, starting with first treatment to reduce COVID-19 deaths. British researchers say an inexpensive and commonly available medicine can help save the lives of those seriously ill with the coronavirus. The first time a drug has been found to cut deaths from the disease. Scientists found that the treatment, a steroid called dexamethasone, reduced deaths among those on ventilators by 1/3 and among those on oxygen by 1/5. This is the only drug so far that has been shown to reduce mortality, and it reduces it significantly, Chief Investigator Peter Horby from Oxford University tells BBC.com. It's a major breakthrough. The drug, which costs less than $1 per day of treatment, is a workhorse steroid widely used to treat inflammation in people with conditions such as asthma and arthritis. Doctors suspect it is effective against COVID-19 because it prevents some of the potentially fatal organ damage caused by the cytokine storms when the immune system goes into overdrive as it tries to fight the coronavirus and begins attacking the body. The randomized controlled clinical trial the gold standard for medical research, involved 2,100 severely ill COVID-19 patients. The researchers say their findings, which have yet to be peer-reviewed, suggest dexamethasone could save the life of 1 in 8 patients on a ventilator and 1 in 20 to 25 on oxygen. They emphasized, however, that the drug showed no benefits for those not on respiratory support and cannot prevent people from catching the virus. Our neighborhood aliens, using a complex series of calculations, astrophysicists say they have come up with an estimate for the number of contactable alien civilizations in our galaxy. It's 36. This is an answer of sorts to the Drake equation, the 7 factors set out by astronomer Frank Drake in 1961 that are needed to determine the number of civilizations out there. Most of the variables have been unknown, but scientists plugged in new data about the number of exoplanets that have been discovered. Basically, we made the assumption that intelligent life would form on other Earth-like planets like it has on Earth, co-author Christopher Consalis from the University of Nottingham in England tells The Guardian. On that basis, Consalis and his colleagues estimated that there are likely 4 to 211 civilizations in the Milky Way that are capable of communicating with others, with 36 as the most likely number. We shouldn't expect the little green men to be in touch anytime soon, though. Consalis says his calculations suggest the closest civilization is 17,000 light years away, and that Earthlings will have to survive at least another 6,120 years before contact is made. And we'll head right over to the Talking Points page to finish out the hour. We'll start with race rebranding. So long, Aunt Jemima. Many Americans were surprised last week to discover racism in the grocery aisle, said Michael Twitty in NBCNews.com. In this season of racial reassessment ignited by George Floyd's death, several major food companies agreed to rebrand iconic products whose smiling, submissive black mascots are meant to evoke formerly enslaved black cooks. Quaker Oats will rebrand Aunt Jemima pancake mixes, syrups, and other products named in 1889 after a mammy-like character from a minstrel song. Gone, too, is the white-haired, bow-tied Uncle Ben of Uncle Ben's Plantation Rice, named in 1937, along with the black mascots for Cream of Wheat and Mrs. Butterworth. To some Americans, those logos were just friendly faces, but to many black people, they represented ghosts from a time when slaves were happy and our pain had no consequence. Most African Americans will shed no tears for Aunt Jemima, said Darlene Glanton in the Chicago Tribune. But Quaker Oats will not get our gratitude for this long overdue change. The company, now owned by PepsiCo, always knew Aunt Jemima was a racist stereotype, which explains why it redesigned the female mascot twice, in 1968 and 1989. Quaker Oats made millions off her until blatantly racist acts fell out of fashion. Now countless businesses are jumping on the anti-racism bandwagon, said Graham Hilliard in National Review. Companies from Salesforce to Taco Bell have declared, "We stand with the black community. This is a form of woke washing, the cynical appropriation of progressive ideology for commercial ends." As the country has a reckoning with systemic racism, worrying about a corporate logo might feel ridiculous, said Barry Svrluga in the WashingtonPost.com. But that doesn't mean changing it isn't the right thing to do. Put differently, keeping racist images is clearly the wrong thing to do. That's why it's time to finally rename the Washington Redskins. It's outrageous for the NFL team in the nation's capital to to go by a racial slur, said Dave Zirin in TheNation.com. The team's original owner, George Preston Marshall, was a proud white supremacist who had to be forced to integrate his roster. The current owner, Dan Snyder, wrote in 2013 that he would never rename the Redskins. But what was unthinkable then is possible now. And performative anti-racism statements from the NFL won't suffice. Finally, there's nowhere to hide. DACA, Roberts to the rescue. The Supreme Court has saved the dreamers for now, said Jay Michelson in thedailybeast.com. Writing a 5-4 majority decision, Chief Justice John Roberts sided with his four liberal colleagues in branding President Trump's decision to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, arbitrary and capricious. The usually conservative Roberts didn't deny Trump's authority to cancel the program that President Obama created through an executive order in 2012. Instead, he faulted the administration for failing to provide a reasoned explanation for revoking DACA and for not adequately taking into consideration how it would impact the 700,000 so-called dreamers who were brought to this country illegally as children and who are now in college, working, and building lives. It's the second time in a week that the court and Roberts have bucked Trump, having extended federal anti-discrimination protections to people in the LGBTQ community in an earlier ruling. It's another legacy decision for Roberts, said Joan Biskupic in CNN.com. 8 years after he earned the wrath of many Republicans for ruling that Obamacare's individual mandate was legal, he's again defied conservative orthodoxy and preserved the court's reputation as above politics. Actually, Roberts' decision is an invitation for executive mischief, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Theoretically, any outgoing president can now issue unconstitutional executive orders and expect that they will remain in force for years as the next administration jumps through an array of regulatory hoops to unwind them. For the past year, Democrats have threatened to expand and pack the court with liberal justices if the conservative majority continued to offend them with its rulings. Based on the tortured nature of Roberts' reasoning, the campaign of intimidation evidently worked. The ruling is still a temporary victory for dreamers, said Nicole Noria in Vox.com. Essentially, the court left Trump the option to cancel the program again with a more robust rationale. The likelihood of that happening before 2021 is very slim, but time would be on his side if he won in November. The Dreamers still have a long road ahead to achieve their hope of permanent lawful residency in America. For now, they remain just one unwanted election result away from a rude awakening and deportation to a country they don't remember. And we're down to some of the shorter notes. Let's see. We start with America's poverty rate will rise slightly this year from 12.5 to 12.7%, a much smaller increase than expected amid millions of people losing their jobs because of the coronavirus, Columbia University researchers said. Without about $460 billion in federally augmented unemployment benefits and direct stimulus checks, the rate would have spiked to 16.3%, pushing almost 12 million into poverty. Facebook has cited dozens of paid ads from President Trump's reelection campaign for using an inverted red triangle next to text about dangerous mobs. The same symbol was used by the Nazis to designate communists and other members of opposition political parties in concentration camps. Facebook said the inverted red triangle violated its prohibition on organized hate. New York City officials have agreed to remove a statue of President Theodore Roosevelt from outside the American Museum of Natural History. The statue shows Roosevelt riding a horse flanked by a Native American man and an African man who officials say are depicted as subjugated and racially inferior. The U.S. government now has 66 million surplus doses of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine after studies found the drug ineffective in treating COVID-19, and the Food and Drug Administration withdrew a waiver permitting their use. In the poll watch, 19% of Americans cite race relations as the nation's number one problem, the highest number for race since 1968. And we will finish out with a quote. I can't even pronounce the name. Jiddu Krishnamurti, who says, interestingly, "It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.